So, as I promised, I'll tell you who to vote for. It follows a party political broadcast on behalf of the Buddhist Liberation Front. I'm really not going to tell you who to vote for. I have no idea who to vote for. But I've been referring to a traditional Buddhist analysis of the conditioned processes that make up our experience. And I'm going to apply that to the issue of government and see whether there's anything useful there. Just to remind you, the Buddha speaks of everything as being dependently arising. Everything arises in dependence on conditions. When those conditions cease, pass away, change, then the phenomena passes away. The law of universal conditionality, in one way of expressing it. Paticca Samuppada. Paticca Samuppada. And it's really the Buddha's basic insight into the way things are. On that basis, the path that he recommended unfolds. So there are regularities within that conditioned process. It's not moving in one way another one time and a different way another time. You can observe the same set of conditions produce the same effect. And the Buddha himself gave some analysis of different patterns of conditionality that can be observed, especially as regards moral life and as regards the spiritual life, the higher Dhamma life, if you like. And he mentioned other forms of conditionality, but later commentarial tradition, organized what the Buddha said into five broad categories of regularity, of law, in the scientific sense. So there's the laws, the assemblage of regularities, the patterns of regularity that underlie physical matter, inorganic matter. The regularities that are studied by the modern sciences of physics and chemistry. This is what's known as Uttu Niyama. Niyama means order. The Buddha said everything is Nyamata, ordered. In the sense of having regular patterns of cause and effect, condition and effect. So Uttu Niyama, Uttu roughly meaning for the time, for the present purposes, matter. Yes, it's those regularities that we observe in physical matter. Gravity, chemical reaction, and so on. And you can predict that. It's what Newton discovered, that gravity works according to certain discernible patterns, principles. The matter that's studied under the heading of Uttu Niyama organises or becomes organised into systems that reproduce themselves and persist in their being. It's a good Spinozian term, which is called Bija Niyama, Bija meaning seed. So it's the pattern of conditionality that's studied by biology, botany. And it emerges out of a greater sophistication, a greater patterning, a greater organization of Uttu Niyama, physical and inorganic. Bija Niyama organizes itself, or becomes organized, in such a way that from it emerges an instinctive or instinctual intelligence that's connected with perception. So the ability to recognize a scene, to make patterns out of your experience, to take the light waves that hit the nods and cones, my science is desperately shaky, the rods and cones at the back of your eye, and then send signals into your brain, and somehow that emerges as an image of a room full of eager Buddhists. In a very sophisticated process. So this is manomyama. Mano means mind, but here it means mind in, yes, the instinctual, the perceptual, the stimulus response sense. It's the mind that an animal has, and which, of course, we have too. But that instinctual intelligence organises itself, or becomes organised, in such a way that it's able to identify itself. It becomes self-conscious. And that self-consciousness gives rise to a new kind of conditioned process, which is what's called kamma in Pali, karma in Sanskrit, and the familiar term to us all is karma. Karma is the law that states the relationship between intention and experienced effect, volitional activity and experienced effect, whether through the mind, the body, or the speech. What you do, what you, as it were, deliberately do, what you intentionally do, however marginal your intelligence, sets up a response from the world around you. There's a response inly, which is the easiest one to notice, that the use that you put your mind to has an effect on your sense of fulfillment, your sense of frustration, your sense of dis-ease, your sense of ease. Not in the physical sense, I was trying to get at that a little bit in the reflection, but in the mental sense, because you can be quite physically pained and feel mentally at ease. And you can feel physically pleasure, but still be mentally disturbed, if you see what I mean. So, and this operates mainly, or not entirely, but mainly in accordance with the principle of karma. What your mind is like now, in this sense, is the consequence of the way you've been using your mind throughout the day, but actually, in a sense, throughout your life. And when you become more sensitive to your own mental states, you'll notice subtle currents in the mind which go way, way back in your life. And even, according to traditional belief, beyond this life. And as I mentioned in the first night, I had some small experience of this myself, a sort of sense that there's something at the back or the bottom of my mind that is more than just this life. So that's the kamma niyama. The set of conditions that arise when self-consciousness is present. It's what it's the moral order. It's the ethical order. In Buddhism, ethics is a natural matter. Ethics is not guaranteed by any higher power or any external agency. Ethics is built in to the universe. The universe, you could say, is moral. Skillful action leads to a sense of greater fulfillment, of even happiness. It doesn't always mean that you're going to get a pleasant ride, because suffering and pain is part of this life. It's the consequence of your having developed a human consciousness that is heir to all that humans are heir to. But the overall trend and tendency of your mind is determined by your own moral action. That is, those actions that you perform as a self-conscious being. It's a whole big topic, isn't it? But that'll do for the time being. Well, it'll do for tonight. From the kamma niyama, something further develops. As I was saying yesterday, when you are acting morally, it's not just that you know, when you perform a good action, you get a nice, pleasant feeling. In fact, it's not that at all. But consciousness emerges in a richer and more sensitive way. As you act more and more skillfully, the quality of consciousness changes. Indeed, it becomes more sensitive, more receptive, more capable of subtle distinction, subtle refinement, capable of greater and more subtle enjoyment. According to traditional Buddhist teaching, you're able to access dimensions of experience that are not normally accessible. In the traditional cosmologies, you'd be described as God realms, but we don't have to accept that on its face value, as it were. Or maybe we need to accept it on face value, but understand that it means something rather different to what we might think it means. Yes, but you get access to, for instance, the states of dhyana in meditation. Those are the consequence of skillful action. They're not merely the consequence of concentrating your mind through the mindfulness of breathing. They will not come to you if you're not acting skillfully generally. You haven't developed an overall current of skillfulness. Those states of mind will not be accessible to you. So the consequence of karma is the refinement and improvement in the quality of consciousness. That's the consequence of skillful karma, helpful action. And one of the consequences of that kind of skillful action and that kind of increasing subtlety of consciousness and of conscious sensitivity is that you begin to be aware of a wider dimension to life, to your own mind. You begin to be aware that you're not simply restricted to a sort of a narrow self-definition, to an identity. That there's something moving in you, moving around you, that is more than you. You can't accept anybody else either, but it's something more than your own volition. There's a force, a dimension, you could say. You could experience it as a force. There's a current that is there at the back of your own awareness, that is present within life as a permanent possibility, which once you begin to align yourself with it, leads you on to higher and higher dimensions of wisdom, of insight, and of all the corollaries of that. In other words, it's the path. The path unfolds within you. And I say it like that, the path unfolds within you, because it's not really that so much experience as you unfolding the path. The work that you have to do is mainly to create the conditions and then to get out of the way. We looked at that in terms of the stage of spiritual death, letting go, so that you allow a different process to come into play, which is transcending, which goes beyond you as a narrow self-identification. It's not that you become somebody else, it's not that you disappear, but that you experience life, you experience consciousness as something way beyond your normal self-understanding. And this is the Dhamma Niyama. In some ways, this is the most important for us to recognize. All the others are reasonably easy to understand. Certainly the first three are pretty easy to understand, but the fourth actually needs far greater emphasis in our modern culture, because probably most people don't really think about how happiness comes, and there's a general tendency to think, particularly in a Tesco-dominated culture, that happiness comes through consumption, and happiness comes through improved material well-being. Of course it does, up to a certain point. But beyond that point, increased material well-being does not produce greater happiness, and it may indeed reverse itself, as many a millionaire can attest. The karma dimension is one that perhaps we as Buddhists need to promote much more widely, that the recognition that inner satisfaction, that real satisfaction, is not merely dependent upon better better TVs and things like that. But it should be said, I work in India a lot, and a lot of people in India would be a lot happier if they had more. You know, studies show that up to a certain point, it's very difficult to be happy if you're not got a degree of well-being. If you're starving, it's very difficult to be happy. There's a big struggle all over the world to achieve happiness in this at this level, if you like. But for most of us, that's long past. Real happiness, real inner satisfaction, comes not from greater access to material well-being, material goods and so forth. So that's something you really need to promote. You could say there are two dominant models of where happiness comes from. One is of, increased consumption, playing the conventional game, as it were. And the other is obedience to rules, cosmic rules, usually written by God or the like. So you believe the moral order is either externally sanctioned by some kind of God, or you believe that happiness is delivered by material goods. In other words, one is a nihilist point of view, the other a materialist one, but we won't go there. So we need to do much, much more to understand this ourselves. Do we really believe in karma? Do we really have confidence in it? It's interesting, there's a place in the suttas where the Buddha describes one who does not believe in karma as not really a human being. The Buddha said that, not me. In other words, you're not fully self-conscious, because you're not really aware of the relationship between your self-identity and your self-responsibility and the experienced effects. You think it's either due to chance or the luck of the draw or getting the right things or some obedience to some divine sanction. So for Buddhism, the beginning of humanity is where you recognize the relationship between your volitions and the effects that follow them. And yes, somebody who does not believe in this, you really need to be aware of. Interesting thought. There's nothing that somebody will not do if they don't believe in this, if you see what I mean. They're capable of doing anything. That's why, in a way, you can get so much evil from teachings which are a lot to do with good and evil, but which do not rely upon karma, which rely upon external sanctions. So people will burn at stake and so on and so forth in the name of an external set of rules. So karma is perhaps a dimension of conditionality we need to understand better and sort of convince ourselves more thoroughly of. To some extent you can prove it, you can see it. You can see it through doing meditation, can't you? You can see that you do the metta bhavana for a number of times, and you begin to recognize there's a change in the quality of consciousness, at least for a little while afterwards. Often, I think it's some time afterwards you get a sort of a good feeling, as it were, from it. But you can see some change. That's one of the important things about meditation. You get some proof of the effect of karma. The Dhamma Niyama is much more difficult to see unless you've already got some definite experience of it. And probably most people who come to a place like this will have come because they've got some experience of something that is a bit supervenient, that goes beyond what's normal, a sense that there is some dimension to the way the world works that is more than just your willing, and which is a source of satisfaction and fulfillment way beyond what you can get from the fulfillment at a lower level. So the Dhamma Niyama is perhaps something we need to get greater and greater confidence in. In Buddhism, the notion of faith is really very much connected with this Dhamma Niyama. You have confidence that, first of all, life has built into it a moral principle, or a moral dimension, that it's integral to life that moral action leads to greater fulfillment, greater richness of experience.
Hmm. Are you talking about what mystics might experience when you talk about the Dhamma and the Yama?
Yeah, yes, it could be, although not necessarily is it mystical, and of course it depends what you mean by mysticism.
Talking about Blake, eternity and the
Well, yes, it's very clear that Blake was talking of something of that kind. Although it may not be experienced necessarily in those sort of... For Blake, it was obviously something really almost overwhelming. And something that he saw constantly. And for many of the mystics of the Western tradition, you can see that. But it may be simply a very strong, a growing sense of, first of all, richness of experience. This is more to do with the Kama Niyama, so that your experience is accompanied by the beauty, although that beauty may also encompass the painful aspects of life, but a closer and closer sense of engagement with life, in integrity with life, and a greater and greater growing sense of a meaning that goes way beyond a personal meaning, a sense of, for instance, entering into the lives of others, where you don't see so much identity with yourself, but kind of an identity with others, almost of the same degree, in fact, ultimately of the same degree. So it may be, not particularly, hallelujah experiences, but more of a kind of deepening richness and meaning in your life. And probably for most people it's going to be a bit like that, unknown mystic.
Yeah, so you're really speaking about a gradation.
Yes.
You're not talking about a distinct jump.
No. Some people seem to have that natural sort of facility for imaginative experience, which Blake had in spades. It's something that some people, yes, seem to have a natural talent for the creation of images which represent something way beyond themselves. For many of us, it's probably more a sense of growing depth and meaning and understanding and peace and so on. Although we may have our moments, if you see what I mean. But yes, it's not to do with the classic mystic experience where you're on the road to Damascus, you're cast to the ground. It's especially if you're undertaking a spiritual practice, probably something that you won't particularly notice a transition. But there is a transition which it becomes clear to you that you've got more and more confidence in this process within life, and you feel able to sort of give yourself up to it more and more, which can even mean that you can you face death, even nasty death, with complete sort of equanimity and confidence, because you know that there's something sort of implicit, inherent in life that goes beyond that. So yes, I'd say that Kama Niyama gives rise to a greater sense of richness and depth, and the Dhamma Niyama, it gives rise to a greater and greater sense of meaning and a transcendence of a narrow self-clinging identification, which may be experienced quite dramatically, but may is probably for many experienced as a almost something quite ordinary. There's a famous Zen saying, isn't it, that to begin with, mountains are mountains and trees are trees. Then mountains are not mountains and trees are not trees. But in the end, mountains are mountains and trees are trees. So I think it's getting at that it's not to do with another world. It's to do with experience itself, but an experience enriched, deepened, and imbued with a transcendent meaning, a meaning that goes beyond me, and that your faith is a confidence that the universe is like that, and that you can place your weight upon it. Many of us suffer from the nihilism of the times, which is really a sense that life is not trustworthy, and life is in the end not dealing anything but a brief moment of pleasure, a few of them if you're lucky, but yes, from the Buddhist point of view, you can have complete confidence that there are processes within life that, if you give yourself up to them, will lead you to greater and greater richness and depth, and will lead you to greater and greater fulfillment, meaning, transcendence, however you like to put it. So for Buddhism, you could even say that the Dhamma Niyama is almost as if it's a power or force. Of course, it's not a power or force. I'm using the term poetically, perhaps, as Blake would no doubt have said much better than I could, as some dynamic force principle that you can safely give yourself to. So those are the five niyamas. These are the five principles within life. The five patterns within life. Now I want to try to see if we can apply them to the situation we find ourselves in right now. I hope it's not too much of a wrench. We've just been up to the stratosphere, as it were. But I do think it's quite important for us to think about how our involvement with the Dhamma plays out when we get to the ballot box on the 6th of May. I personally consider that it is important for us as Buddhists, if we're so fortunate as to have a vote in this country. Not everybody here probably has a vote, but if you do have the vote, I think it's quite important that you use it. You have that modicum of power which you may be able to make some difference with. I think that as practitioners of the Dhamma, we need to take into account our responsibility for the wider world, our responsibility for society, even responsibility for our political life, even for the government that rules over us. It's very interesting that the Buddha, of course, lived at a time when there was a big transition taking place in North India from essentially tribal oligarchies, which were democratic in the sense that Athens was democratic, a fairly large but nonetheless minority group of people had a vote, and a lot of people didn't. So there was a republican organisation, which the Buddha himself, the tribe that he came from, the clan he came from, had that sort of organisation. But in the Buddha's lifetime, and it was actually visible in the Buddha's sutras, you can see that the new wealth, as the Ganges Delta is getting more, river plain, what's the name? Flood plain, is getting wealthier and wealthier. Power is becoming accumulated in the hands of two or three major monarchies. And so the Buddha lived at a time when these monarchies were coming into being. And in some ways it's quite interesting, it's quite clear that Buddhism grew with a new merchant class and a new ruling class, replacing the old systems of government. Anyway, that's another question. But so the Buddha had to do with several of the major monarchies and the kings of the area in which he taught and moved. And he has, at various times, a certain amount to say to them about what their duties are. And sort of looking at it broadly, you can extrapolate certain principles that are really as applicable now as then. One very interesting fact is that in the Buddhist sutras there are sort of social origins myths, the origins of society, they amount to primitive social contract theories, So that the Aganya Sutta, it's a very famous creation myth sutra, which the Buddha gives as a sort of a way of explaining his view of what life is. He talks about, first of all, the emergence of private property. Then, because of the emergence of private property, the emergence of civil strife. You know, some people appropriate the property of others. People try to deal with them. That leads to violence and so forth. And people get together and they say, you know, rather than this uncontrolled and chaotic, anarchic administration of, well, vengeance rather than justice, why don't we give to the most handsome and powerful person? I'm still hoping. You know, the responsibility for administering justice. So that's, you know, it's not a justification, but it's a sort of explanation, you know, very much like the Enlightenment theories of social contract. Shows quite definitely that in the Buddha's accounts, there's quite definitely a sense of the responsibility of the government to the people, that the government acts on behalf of the people. Of course, there wasn't an idea of democracy in the modern sense, although within the Sangha, there was, broadly speaking, a democratic system, although it's more complicated than that. But I find it quite interesting that there was a sort of recognition that government is consensual. That's the first thing, I think, to note about the Buddhist approach to government. The second is the role of the Sangha, the role of those who are leading a full-time spiritual life. And by and large, their role is admonitory. Their role is to keep government up to scratch. I was going to say wag the finger, but you know what I mean. Engage with power, to show the moral duty of those with power. And there are many, many Jataka stories in which either the Buddha, that is, stories about the Buddha in past lives, whether you believe them literally or not, in which the Buddha is either the king or he's an advisor to the king, often playing a decisive part in recalling the king to his moral duty. So that's quite interesting and important for us as practitioners of a spiritual life.
Mm. It's so interesting to see that, because I was watching television, watching these riots on television in Thailand.
And
there was one monk, he was definitely a monk, and he was really laying into some geezer in a cast, and, you know, really wagging a finger at him.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really weird, him getting involved.
Yeah. There was a very big debate in the Theravada Sangha about the political role of the Sangha. And unfortunately, in some cases, it's been really quite malign. So in Sri Lanka, the Buddhist monks led the racist attacks on Tamils, often sword in hand. So it's a bit of a vexed question. But traditionally, the role of the spiritual community is to keep alive moral principles, which is not what I think was happening in Sri Lanka. And what probably, you know, the monks that you saw would have seen themselves as doing. But of course, Burma is the place where we're most familiar with the debate about the moral role of the Sangha. And you know, tragically, very, very tragically, in recent times, monks taking to the streets to call for democracy and being mown down. Anyway, The admonitory role, the role of the Sangha in trying to remind government of its responsibility. So presumably what you could say is it's those who have some sense of the Kamma Niyama and the Dhamma Niyama need to try to bring an awareness within society as a whole, and especially to those who carry power, of the moral character of reality, and of the consequence of going against moral order, for the individuals, for society. And that there's, you could say that there's quite a clear pattern of advice. First of all, it's said that the king, that's for king, say government, in India, modern Indian languages, Rajya rather than Raja, the government has the duty of ruling in accordance with Dhamma. In other words, in accordance with the fundamental principle of things. That means in accordance with the way things actually are, not with some constructed reality, not with some grand theory about things, whether it's communist or capitalist, come to that. It's a question of trying to rule in accordance with the way things really are, and especially with the way things are from a moral point of view. So it's the duty of government to act morally, to be moral, to act morally, and to uphold morality. The upholding of morality is twofold. First of all, in punishment and reward. So it's in the administration of justice, in other words. The system of justice, which is administered by the government, needs to be in accordance with Kamma. So Kamma should be the guiding principle. The laws should be, broadly speaking, in accordance with the fundamental moral character of things, which is not human constructed, but is implicit in the nature of things. So it's the duty of the government to administer justice, to keep order in accordance with moral principles. It's secondly, that in this respect, the duty of government to promote morality, to educate, if you like, the populace in an understanding of moral principles. This, I think, is a very, very interesting question in the modern social situation. Where you hear teachers saying that it's become very, very difficult to teach because students are not getting taught any sort of moral principles at home. You know, teachers, of course, always say that, and the older generation always says it of the younger. But there seems some good evidence that this is the case. There's a decay of moral sensibility. Personally, I think that this is to do with our situation as still cruising on a Christian morality without the beliefs that underlie it. That we've got the remnants of Christian morality, which have sort of endured in a kind of late humanism, but it's gradually running out under the pressure of the sort of consumerist self-fulfillment ideology of the times. So, the question is: how does a government promote morality without espousing any particular religious perspective? A very, very difficult issue, and something that I think that in our engagement with politicians we need to be testing them on. For a start, we need to be asking about their morality, expense accounts, etc. We need to be asking them about issues of corruption, of the corruption of their influence, and so forth. I don't think this necessarily means that because somebody's changed their husband or wife that they're necessarily immoral, if you see what I mean. But I don't particularly like that rather prurient element that comes into British politics, which the French are delightfully free of, surprisingly. Really a question of their moral behaviour as politicians, as government. A question of to what extent laws are really in conformity with basic moral principles, and a question of how they intend to promote morality within society. These are questions that it's very, very important to understand. Then the duty of government, according to the Buddhist scriptures, is to promote the material well-being of people. It's to ensure a reasonable degree of equity in the distribution of material well-being, because inequity leads to social strife. There's an interesting question for modern Britain, which has become more and more unequal in the last years. One of the in the sort of the myth of the social myth, there's a period where great strife emerges, and it's because some people have been left desperately poor and other people have become incredibly rich, which leads to social tensions which break down in strife. So it's the duty of governments to look after the material well-being of all, and to ensure a reasonable degree of equity. It's not not a sort of promoting, it doesn't seem to be talking about a communist style equity, if you see what I mean, but a reasonable degree of equity, so that there's not social tension, where some people are not so frustrated by want that they resort to violence. So the Buddha says that you need to make sure that there's a reasonable degree of equity, for fairness sake, as it were, but also for the preservation of social order. The duty of government is to look after the helpless. And I must say, it's one of the things that I find really makes me proud to be a citizen of this country. That, for instance, there's such care given to make sure that places have, wide entrances and ramps and so forth, so that those who are disadvantaged have access as much as possible to a full life. I think it's something really quite remarkable, and that people with severe disability are supported to such a quite extraordinary degree. I think it really is a sign of civilization. I know that it can be very frustrating at times and very expensive, but I think it's a mark of a culture in which there is a real regard to moral principles, at least in that respect. There are many other respects in which we're deficient. But the Buddha says there should be provision of welfare for those who are helpless, orphans, the incapacitated, the mentally incapacitated in any way, should be protected. It's the duty of government to ensure they're protected. It's the duty of government to provide medical care, to ensure that medical care is provided. Hear that, Americans? You're African American, not American. You told me yesterday. It's the duty of governments to even provide care for animals. It's one of the remarkable things about the Ashokan rock edicts, that Ashoka, in some of those rock edicts, enjoined that there should be hospitals for animals. He felt really at home in England. We love our pets, they do too. It's the duty of government to care for, if you like, well-being at the level of the Uttu, Bija and Mano Niyama, to ensure that people have broadly what they need in terms of food, of sustenance, of housing, to ensure that they are educated in a basic human way, that those who have disabilities of any kind are cared for, whether mental disabilities, physical disabilities, that children are properly looked after and educated. There should be widespread education available to all. Yes, it's the duty of government to provide for the lower niyamas, quite clearly stated. It's the duty of government, and this is where it gets, as I've said, very interesting, to provide for the upholding of the moral order, so that the system of justice, as closely as possible, approximates to karma. Of course, it can never be absolute, and to some extent, it has to be arbitrary. You know, whether you do things this way or that way. But in the end, it should be governed by moral principles. But most interesting of all, it's the duty of governments to look after those who wish to fulfil a higher Dhamma life. So how does this translate in modern Britain? How does it translate at our elections? I'd say, first of all, that it translates in it being the duty of government to make sure that higher life of a cultural kind is maintained. There's a lot of debate about this, isn't there, whether money should be going to ballet, or, you know, whether you consider that a higher kind of life is another question. But you know, whether money should be going to what are, to some extent, you know, so-called elitist arts. But I think it is the duty of government, according to these Buddhist principles, that those aspects of culture that carry something that goes beyond the merely human, as it were, are kept alive. That culture and learning that is, in a sense, useless is encouraged, even maintained. You know, how you do that, whether it's by direct subsidy or whether it's by tax provision or whatever, whether it's by having state flagship arts, is another question. But to me, it seems that the Dhamma Niyama's first sort of glimpse for most people is in some response to art and culture. It's some response to those aspects of art and culture that carry something that's greater than human, that carry some sense of enduring spiritual moral principles, which can be found anywhere, can even be found in quite a popular culture at times, but in most enduring forms in you know, the classical arts, I suppose. I think a healthy society keeps those things alive. Of course, to some extent, it's the duty of government to get out of their way and not to restrict them. But to some extent, it's the duty of government to provide fora for them and to ensure that they do flourish. It's a very tricky area because government tends to promote what suits it, as it were. What suits its constituencies, well, like Stalin promoted socialist realism as a vehicle for his particular view of society. So governments tend to have an ideological stake in culture. And it's perhaps our duty as electors, and here in Bethnal Green, Buddhists are 1% of the electorate, maybe more. Probably more, because it's 1% of the population, but probably most of us are electors, are voters. It's our duty to make sure that our representatives see the importance of culture as a transmitter of values, and that they do put effort into maintaining those values. Not merely promoting the values of particular groups, which also needs to be done, but promoting those cultural values that are belong to humanity, if you see what I mean, rather than particular parts of humanity. Then, of course, the duty of government is to allow space for those who wish to lead a full-time spiritual life, or even a part-time spiritual life. We want to lead any kind of spiritual life. Probably we benefit from traditions in this country. We benefit from the preamble to the Charities Act of 1564 under Elizabeth, which allows for religious charities to be tax exempt. It's a small way in which government provides space for the leading of spiritual life. This space is a recognised place of religious worship, which gives it certain privileges and exemptions. I think we're allowed to burn you all to death without reference to the government. not that we have to get permission from it, you know what I mean. lowered safety standards. They're only worshippers, they can burn. They're used to it. Sorry, black humour over. There are ways in which government needs to allow for, promote the leading of what is an economically useless life, recognising that, well, that's what I've led all my life. I was economically productive, but actually I've never been. I worked in a Smedley's pea factory for a while. I've been economically useless all my life, and I'm proud of it. In fact, I've been trying to undermine the economy as best I can by promoting people's leading a simple life against the advice of our great leader, who wanted us all to shop our way out of recession. I've got lost in my own jokes. I'm supposed to be getting near the end of the session. We need to. A government needs to provide space for the leading of a life which is a developing higher states of consciousness, which is exploring new realms of understanding and so forth. By and large, it simply needs to keep out of the way, because there are cultures, many cultures, where we wouldn't be able to do this. We certainly wouldn't be able to in many Islamic cultures. I remember we got a phone call in at Marjah Maloka from a guy in Palestine, in Ramallah. He's ringing up and he's saying he'd only could talk for a few moments, but he'd read about the Buddha, and he felt an immediate strong affinity, and he'd been sort of trying to read up on Buddhism, but he could not let anybody know that he was doing this. His life would be in danger if he did. So, even a spiritual life in the form of Sufism in some Islamic cultures is not really permitted. And in many cultures, it's not really possible to give yourself full time to that sort of life, for various reasons, for different reasons. So we're very lucky, we do have quite a bit of space here for that. And something is very important for us to do is to keep alive the freedom to do that. The freedoms that allow us to pursue a quite different kind of life to that which is common in our culture. And to make sure that we're able to propagate that life and to support it. So... maybe I haven't told you who to vote for, but I've suggested ways in which we might want to interrogate our candidates. And I think it would be very, very good if, for instance, we did ask the major candidates in this constituency to come here, all of them, and to face a variety of questions under the sort of headings that I've given. Maybe don't sort of try to explain to them the five nearmost. I doubt if they'd listen for long enough. But, ask them a number of questions which concern us. Even if they don't really know what to make of it, they've heard our voice. And, what I've found is that, by and large, if people hear your voice, it does affect them. They have to take that into account. They modify their way of speaking. And after all, politicians are... That's what their game is modifying their way of speaking to satisfy the greatest number of people. So we need to engage in some sort of dialogue with them. So if I can respectfully suggest to the chairman of the London Buddhist Centre, it's a presidential piece of advice, maybe it would be a good idea to have, in some situation around here, some sort of forum where Buddhists meet our candidates and put some questions to them and decide who are the candidates who are most likely to promote, to govern, in the sense that the Buddha asked government to function, and to let our voice be heard. I believe that we've got to do much, much more to let our voice be heard in the mainstream of our culture. We've got to promote the Kamic point of view. We've got even to promote the Dhammic point of view. The Dhamma Niyama needs to be heard in the mainstream of society. I think that we tend to look to the alternative, to the fringe, because we've got more affinity, seemingly. But actually, it's the mainstream that we need to be addressing. And right now, we've got a window of opportunity. At the moment, their ears are long. They need us. They need our backing. I'm not suggesting that the LBC then says, the LBC recommends that you vote for X, Y, or Z. I don't think that's the way to do it. We need to make up our minds individually. But I think that if we can engage with that sort of critical dialogue with our politicians, and keep that up once they're elected, call them in once a year. We've certainly done this at Papaloka. The local politicians have been in to see us, and in the old days when I was there, I don't know whether they do it now. And we'd put them to the test. For instance, when the Conservative candidate came, we asked her about Clause 26, which, you know, is not permitting the promotion of homosexuality, promotion of it, even positive discussion of in schools and so forth. And she gave a very satisfactory answer. She thought it was abominable, and had already been in contact with her party to say she could not support that. And so on. There are many, many issues that we can get into active dialogue with our politicians about, especially from our unique point of view. A unique point of view, which is a compassionate point of view, of course, which sees that the welfare of society as a whole as lying in our meeting people's real material needs and their mental needs, but which is a comic point of view, which sees reality as being implicitly moral, and that the social order needing to be underlined by moral principles, and which sees Dhamma as the fundamental principle of things, and as a motivation that will arise in many, many people, at least to some extent, at least at the level of a sense of a higher meaning, a higher cultural meaning, but which for many will also mean a higher kind of life altogether. So I hope that's been helpful. I hope at least gives you a way to engage with the political process that's going on around us right now, the boring political process where it really is hard to distinguish between what you're hearing. But I think we need to go to the individual politicians and use the fact that Britain still has a constituency-based electoral system, which has its advantages. It means that we have a direct connection with the local representative. So there you are. I hope you can see how this analysis of conditionality applies to us in our own personal lives, and our own personal spiritual lives, and describes to some extent what it is that we're trying to do here in the centre, and what presumably most of you have been coming because you've been touched by these Gautama Niyama and the Dhamma Niyama, but which also gives us a way of thinking about our responsibility to the wider society and our relationship to government.